This episode is brought to you by HivePass. HivePass is the latest in membership management software that brings a radically different approach to how members join your organization, their experience as a member, and how you interact with them. Built by not only an app developer, but also a mountain biker, HivePass was made by a trail user for trail users. With an app-based platform, instant digital membership cards, ability to send push notifications to members, in-app trail status reports unique to your organization, HivePass is building the next generation of membership management software for your organization. Future additions to HivePass include an event system, automated custom trailhead signs, and much more. HivePass has been live in New Zealand and Australia for a few years, but just launched in Canada, and with this announcement, the United States. Over 50,000 trail users already use HivePass to support their local trail organization. HivePass is the world's first app-based membership management software built specifically for trail organizations. For all of the details, check out hivepass.app. That's www.hivepass.app. Or download the HivePass app today. You're listening to Frontlines, a podcast for the people that truly make mountain biking happen. Not the riders, racers, or product designers, but the builders, advocates, and the often forgotten board members of your local mountain bike trail association. Well, I'm excited to bring a run of episodes as we enter into the Northern Hemisphere summer season. It's peak digging and riding time here. Winter ended early here, both in snowpack and in mindset. I'm excited about a new sponsorship with HivePass, which you heard at the top of this episode. In an upcoming episode, we'll spend some time getting to know them a bit better, so stay tuned for that. Some of you have been involved with the creation of this episode. A new initiative for 2024 is to try and get more listener feedback and direction. It's my goal that these discussions go in all sorts of different directions, but to also remain helpful to the core of the listenership. So prior to an episode, my plan is to send an email to a list of Frontlines VIPers. That will allow you to get involved in not only what questions get asked, but who I even interview. How do you become a VIPer? Well, right now it's exclusive to those who have donated to the podcast. So if you want to support the podcast, click on the donate link in the show notes. As for this episode, we're looking at waste and the negative byproducts that come with gear-intensive outdoor recreation and how it could become more sustainable in the future. So without further delay, I'm your host, Brent Hillier, and this is episode 89 of Frontlines. I'm joined today by Miguel Santos. He's a sustainability professional and founder and CEO of Wonderflux. Hey, Miguel, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Brent. It's great to be here. Stoked about it.
Let's get started with what exactly is a sustainability professional?
Great question. I would say over the last 20 years, that title has fluctuated incredibly extensively over a wide spectrum of work. Either context in industry or actual responsibilities, if it's in the field, if it's in an office, with government, even with nonprofits. I'd say given the inability for sustainability practitioners or professionals to kind of harness a very stable definition of the work we do, it has had the propensity to fluctuate in a manner that's kind of hard to tie down. Today, how I would define this is essentially someone working in a specific industry, personally for me, that's the private sector, in a way that's trying to help companies and individuals understand what their environmental, social, and governance impacts are. Again, that's a bit of a nebulous way to define it, but I guess for me, the most easy way to say it is I work hard to figure out ways to solve social and environmental problems.
Awesome. Your company, Wonderflux, how long has it been around for and how did it get started?
Yeah, so this has been a really interesting, fun project. We're a team of three, and I founded it about 2 years ago. We're all three people super passionate about circular design and sustainability innovation in the product sphere, specifically outdoor recreation. And so we've been trying with our spare time to kind of bootstrap this project together. And what we're trying to do is combine our varied backgrounds in material science, mechanical engineering, and sustainability strategy to figure out a way to disrupt everyday products with circular products that kind of enable circular design to flourish and compete with those linear single-use plastics options that we find are so pervasive in a lot of things, but especially with outdoor recreation, which I think is slightly ironic. And so given that we're all really passionate outdoor recreationalists, we thought it'd be a great way to kind of drive a wedge into some of the challenges we find in terms of the products that we use in the places that we care a lot about. And so we have a couple prototyping projects going on right now, as well as trying to figure out a way to harness the knowledge we gather in these activities to then consult for other companies that are, you know, striving to innovate in similar ways or being challenged by certain problems that we have a really unique way of trying to attack in a way, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's something that I think for the longest time, I'd come back from backpacking trips and I would think about these wonderful places that I would get to visit, you know, remote, beautiful, pristine, wild spaces and protected spaces. And then I'd come back and I'd unpack my backpack after, you know, 2-3 nights out there, and the amount of soft plastic garbage that I would accumulate, just in packaging for, you know, dehydrated meals or trail mix and all this kind of stuff. And it really just bugged me that, like, this was, to do one thing kind of meant this. And it does feel like, you know, that you mentioned ironic. It's that, like, snake eating its own tail kind of thing, in the sense that we love to recreate in these spaces, but at the same time, we might actually be contributing quite a bit to harming them and damaging them. What is circular design? Like, explain for us what that actually means.
Yeah, absolutely. But before I get into that, I do have to agree with you on the insanity that it might feel as backcountry enthusiasts, especially, to watch yourself put gram after gram of plastic in an ultralight kit, for me at least. And then you come home with all these empty wrappers. So I think we got to find a moment to really jump into that, because I know for sure a lot of your listeners are just, like, banging their heads against the wall with the same problem as well. But in that discussion point, circular design, circular economy, let's first talk about what sustainability means, I guess. And from there, we can kind of throw a couple filters in to get down to the circular economy. From a high level, in 1987, there was a Brundtland report released at an international commission and essentially stated the term sustainable development to be meaning the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So already there's this theme around, okay, sustainability means we're not sacrificing the future for the now. We're not extracting amounts that are unsustainable in a way that they are now to be finite. They will enable themselves to regenerate, to allow for future generations to kind of maintain their livelihoods. Under this theme, we've seen, especially with slightly more linear systems, very extractive systems, such as our, you know, bread and butter economic system right now called capitalism, where things are extracted from natural environments, manufactured and produced, used, and then thrown away. The problem with that is we're harnessing a tremendous amount of resources initially and disposing of nearly all of it. And that is absolutely inefficient and incredibly incongruent with the circular systems that the planet actually utilizes constantly around us. Even our own bodies are circular systems. So there's a bit of a disconnect there. And it was understanding that initially that really fascinated me with this challenge that we have, where we have such an intrinsic part of our society completely linearized, if that's even a word, overlaid on top of a very circular system that we all depend on for our basic needs. Circular economy kind of brings that focus down to this challenge and makes us, or tries to force us, to think in circles. So if we're extracting something and then producing it and then selling it and then using it, how can we bring that valued material back around to be reutilized, reused, recycled, composted? So not just bringing materials back into a kind of human-centered production chain again, but also can they be reintroduced to environmental systems via composition, decomposition? And so circular design kind of asks the question of, okay, how can we eliminate waste? How can we circulate products and materials? especially at their highest value, and how can we regenerate nature? So for us at Wonderflux, this comes into light with our material selection. So what's readily available as either a waste stream from another industry, or naturally produced or a byproduct of another process that we can use? Or what's a very low impact production material that also has a high level of recyclability or reusability? We're always trying to avoid things that are incredibly expensive to make, require a lot of energy or materials, create a lot of effluent or byproducts that are not usable at all and are more automatically a waste stream. And also things that are really intensive when it comes to emissions. But also, what can we reuse, repair, or divert to another user at the end of their life cycle as well? So it's trying to contain things in a container of sorts that allow you to, you know, for lack of a better term, not throw away anything. How can we close off that system? That's circular economy, circular design in a nutshell. And I think the last note I want to make here is not forgetting that there is a regenerative quality to all this as well. So improving communities, improving environments, not just taking and using. Can there be ways to transmit positive outcomes through a product, through a manufacturing process, through a diversion exercise, that kind of thing?
One of the listeners of the podcast, I had a great kind of email exchange with him, Jeff from Affordable Trail Solutions. He brought up an interesting point that we use the term sustainable trails as trail builders. And he kind of mentioned that this can be a bit of a frustrating term, because I think, and I'm, you know, paraphrasing his sentiment here, but that it infers that we're building something that doesn't require maintenance, that is just solid and isn't going to take anything. But I think what I'm hearing from you with this kind of circular design is it's a long process and requires work and all the way through, not just the development and the design and the production of a product, but all the way through its life. And one of the remarks that Jeff made was that instead of kind of using the term sustainable trails, he liked kind of switching it out for like low maintenance, medium maintenance, and high maintenance to describe certain trails. And that could be, you know, the user types that are on the trail, or the amount of users on that trail versus the actual location of the trail and the environment on that trail. And when I think about products that I use, gear that I use, there's some of it that I have a very low maintenance schedule on, that stuff that I own that has lasted me many, many years. And I have stuff that has a high maintenance schedule as well. How do we shift? And this is a huge concept question, and I don't know if we could answer it today, but how do we start to shift the culture to get away from just thinking that it's normal to throw something out and buy something new? Because that's really what it seems like needs to happen.
Is that it? You want anything else to add to that?
Yeah. Just that.
No, it's a fantastic question. And you know what? A question that's central to a lot of discussions in this space, especially when people that wear my hat in the corporate or private sector world tried to think about a lot, because when I found myself working as a sustainability manager professional for a company or even a consultancy, the cloud that was always hanging over us was ROI on either investments or outcomes, where the business had to thrive, period. It didn't matter how badly I wanted a certain investment to be made in a newer technology that might have lowered certain emissions, or a new material that would have raised costs but lowered impact. There had to be an establishment of a healthy ROI for whatever sustainability, quote unquote, project we were working on. And in that regard, I think your question fits in neatly into that, under the fact that a lot of these buy and sell and throw away and rebuy has to do with just this capitalistic ideology that we find ourselves in. And it's no fault of anyone. These economic systems thrive on making sales, moving product, and throwing away, because throwing away really doesn't cost anyone much. And so, you know, capitalism hasn't done a really good job of centering or taking account of externalities. And a lot of work in sustainability or environmental management of any type is understanding what these externalities look like. So what's the cost of doing X in the natural environment or in our communities? You know, speaking upon that, like there's a lot of misuse of the word sustainability when it comes to social work or things to do with governance. So things around human rights, inequalities, that type of thing, community health, access to healthcare, access to a variety of things from a human perspective. I think there's a lot of misuse where we think a lot about sustainability in an environmental context. That being said, when it comes to the purchase of goods, the almost reflexive thinking that, hey, you know what, it's not as good as it used to be, or it's out of fashion, or no one's using this anymore, I'm just going to chuck it, is incredibly entrenched. And I think there's a social aspect here that is very hard to dismantle. And it's not so much of a professional question and solution type of scenario for a lot of us. I think a lot of it is quite societal. I think the outdoor community is quite well positioned to chip away at this and lead by example. In fact, a lot of the brands that we see kind of carrying our banners, the Patagonias of the world, definitely have a voice in this. And I do think that folks in companies like that do have their values in the right place to try and start the discussion. But again, they are beholden to that revenue model, right? And so it's really hard. I mean, I've been struggling this myself for years now, where my main interaction with the outdoor world is through fishing trips, long mileage hiking, trails and backcountry trips. As a recently backcountry, snowboarding as well. Thanks for the Abbey training. Appreciate it. You were awesome. And so for me, it's all about how can I extend the use of the materials I have now, but also making that decision when I purchase things as well. And so I find out there's a lot of a push and pull in the outdoors recreation space with costs and access to these activities. And sometimes they can be cost prohibitive. And so, you know, it's totally understandable for people to be kind of making slightly less intensive economic purchases to access things, but then finding out that, oh, this didn't work as I thought it would, or this didn't fit as I thought it would, or this broke down earlier than I thought it would. So you have this push and pull around quality and price and access. I think for me, the best chance we have is education around, you know, is it really necessary for me to get this piece of gear if I still have this one? And if it is, normalizing the buy and sell economy as well, which I think a lot of things like Facebook Marketplace have actually done for us. I think the whole thrifting culture has become really strengthened lately from more like a fashionable standpoint, but also the Facebook Marketplace buy and sell mindset has really expanded as well. And I think people are placing a lot of value in that. And for some reason, I noticed a lot of, for lack of a better term, backcountry users have never really shied away from that. Of course, we all know the gearheads that need the next brightest and shiny toy. Sometimes that could be me. But I think the values and the attitudes there are really just all about, you know, I kind of need this piece of gear and I don't want to shell out, you know, thousands of dollars for it. And this seems pretty good. I can make this work. I can repair it. I find people in this space are really handy and don't mind puzzles. And sometimes gear can offer that kind of a challenge and a reward as well.
Yeah, there's a few things that I want to touch on in that response, you know, the first one, you know, I think it's good to be reminded because it's something that I haven't thought about in a while, but even just the culture shift that we've had around thrifting and the buy and sell kind of market out there. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, like the worst thing imaginable was having clothes bought at the thrift store to to go to school the next day. And that was just a, an absolute nightmare when I was growing up.
Right?
Being like, the kids are going to make fun of
that.
Me. And, and that's totally shifted now, which is great. And this, there's so much that I work a lot with school programs and youth programs. And I think there's always, you know, that classic complaining of Xennials and the next generation. But I see so much that has been improved on by younger generations, these culture shifts that I think are really, really healthy and really, really good, that I see promise. And I think, you know, I have to remind myself that when the time comes, you know, to make sure that I step aside, because I think there is a really healthy kind of group of youth that have shifted the conversation, shifted the culture with that stuff, which is amazing. Outdoor people kind of being problem solvers and creative. And I think that's something I haven't really thought about with, I love fixing and maintaining things. I'm currently in a battle right now with my dishwasher.
oh no.
And it, well, you know, it's a fun battle, right? And you know, trying to figure out the problem and the solution. There's nothing more rewarding than fixing something. And that feeling that you get from it is so great. And as adventurous outdoorsy people, I think we can tap into that a little bit more than maybe folks that aren't doing those types of activities. That's the problem solving skills that are required in the outdoors. You know, when you're on a backpacking trip or you're on a mountain bike ride and something breaks, you know, you don't have the option of buying something new. You have to fix it in those moments if you want to get back home. And so we have that kind of culture there. And I think tapping into it more, it would be really good for us and encouraging it. You know, that's another piece to this. You also mentioned Patagonia, and that's, I wanted to bring up Patagonia because they've got a new campaign. They've got like a movie, Thropocene, I think is what they're calling it. I don't know if I have to bleep that out or not, but, it also kind of comes off of, you know, Patagonia wants to stop buying crap is kind of what they're saying. And they also had a campaign. I can't remember when it was, but it was a number of years ago. It was the don't buy this jacket. It was the Black Friday sale that New York Times ad telling people not to buy something. And it's great. But then at the same time, they make a bunch of sales on that ad. And so where's that line of like, you know, is it just greenwashing or is it actually helping to push the conversation and change the way that we view gear and how we purchase it and how we maintain it and does it actually help?
Fair question, Brent. Fair question. I mean, everybody in this space that I've talked to that I know has greenwashing on their mind. It's kind of always the elephant in the room. A lot of professionals in the ESG/sustainability space, ESG, sorry, meaning environmental social governance work. So essentially what sustainability has become in the private sector is kind of under this label of ESG now. It's a hot topic. Anyways, just a little side note there. I think greenwashing it's kind of always been the termite in the block of wood that we call sustainability or sustainability innovation or corporate social responsibility, where a lot of folks internal to these companies who are trying to innovate responsibly and who are trying to be sustainable are always caught in the middle of the push and pull between marketing and communication points and trying to attract those value based users who want to see the businesses and companies around them doing better. They're stuck between trying to work on things that give those departments and those individuals speaking points to be able to make that poster saying, oh, all these trees are being planted or all this waste is being diverted. They're between that objective, the objective inherently from their role to be doing something well and innovative and better for the world, better for people. And then the other end being, we need to sell this jacket or this widget or this pencil. And in that regard, this role, this profession is situated in an incredibly unique place in a lot of organizations. where you inherently want to be doing something that's positive. You inherently want to be supporting the business and how the business is able to communicate outwardly and interact with its users or other stakeholders. But you are so darn beholden to the realities of running a business and surviving as a business. And sometimes there are companies who are trying so darn hard to do well and get caught with their hands in the honey jar of either amplifying unreasonably so their metrics or what they're able to communicate about a certain product or material or outcome, or they're caught just blatantly making something up because they believe, well, there's no way in hell that anyone's going to tell us that we are doing something inaccurate or this isn't true. There's no way to measure this, or so they might think. And then there's other companies that are doing so damn well, pushing the boundaries so far, that might find it a little bit hard to truly communicate the impacts of what they're doing, because there's a measurability to all this as well, right? At the core of greenwashing, it's a sentiment or a marketing tactic or an advertisement or a statement or a statistic that's publicized. And then there's a gap between what was presented and what's able to be spoken about in a black and white manner to prove that to be true, right or wrong, or true. And a lot of times, the average person doesn't have the tools available to really dissect that or sift through it. And even though you have a lot of organizations working hard on this challenge, or you have educated consumers working on this and trying to voice whether things are really impressive and incredible or actually a little bit shady. And so there's an education piece to all this that, again, continues to rear its head up in this conversation, where it's really all about people being able to spend the time researching what's being presented to them. Because at the end of the day, what a lot of, you know, quote unquote greenwashers are trying to do out in the market, and a lot of them are pretty correct about this, is knowing that people want to feel good about a purchase and they don't really care too much about making sure that what's being told to them is factual. All they want to do is feel like, you know what, pat on the back, I made a good purchase because this shirt is going to be doing X, Y, and Z in this environment, or this shirt has used this material, which is actually better than this material, or whatever it is, right? We're looking for that easy win on, you know, kind of allowing us to pat ourselves on the back for that value aligned purchase. And it's a fantastic feeling, especially when this, you know, has become a bit of a hot topic where, you know, a lot of companies are, the growth of sustainable brands has been incredibly quick, as per the importance that a lot of investment firms are placing in sustainable companies and kind of expanding their portfolios in this area. It's because people feel really good and enjoy buying things that they know or have been told are great for the planet or communities. Unfortunately, that gap, at least, you know, in the last 3 to 5 years, has widened tremendously, where there's a gap between what companies feel like they can say and how far our consumers want to go to really dig into that. It's about as wide as it's ever been. Thankfully, there are either in industry-specific regulations or, you know, even policies that are coming into play that are tightening up that wiggle room for companies to be able to label certain things or market certain things that are actually inaccurate or things that are able to be conclusively deemed factual. And so thankfully, we've seen a number of legal battles happening where certain companies, incredibly large companies, have been brought to court for certain things that they've said about their products or their outcomes that have actually been incorrect. And so there is a bit of a legal system there, kind of allowing us to close the gap between what's allowed to be marketed. And so that'll kind of lighten the burden on the consumer to feel like they have to dig a little deeper into what they're seeing. But for me, I guess it's all about trusting certain brands that continue to kind of push the bar. And for me, those are the Patagonias of the world, the Arc'teryxes of the world with their new Rebirth program, where you see companies walking the talk, where yes, we'll take back these certain products and we'll be refurbishing them, we'll be repairing them. Those are ways to really identify brands that are kind of putting their best foot forward and leading by example. Be wary of the companies that don't seem to be supporting you as a customer on that front line with your damaged good or your product that you actually don't want to keep anymore because it's aged. Products or companies that don't have certain modular designs where you can, you know, easily bring in a product to get repaired. Companies that aren't accepting take back programs. Things of that nature, I think, are great ways to kind of immediately dispel any worries that a company might just be, you know, spewing hot air out into the market. In other circumstances, it's kind of hard without those, you know, examples that you can, you know, kind of truly interact with as a user or a customer to really understand what's going on behind closed doors. But you know, there's ways to sift through it. And at the end of the day, I think if you don't see the true commitments to a company, either to their community or to the surrounding environment or how they're making, designing, or managing their products or business practices, is to kind of take ownership over that end as best you can with how you're able to manage their products, how you're able to either repurpose, reuse, recycle, upcycle any materials or products that you come into contact with or that you purchase yourself. I mean, it's incredible how many things can be repurposed, resold, repaired from the safety of your own home or your own community. So that's also a way to kind of add that agency to the customer when it comes to really expanding the impacts of what a product or service can do while not truly relying on what the company is able to do for you or in that context. It kind of allows you to control some of that narrative. But yeah, research can only take you so far, and sometimes you're going to have to really rely on what other organizations are able to tell you about a certain company and their practices, or what the legal system is showing based off of any challenges.
Something that I want to go back to that you mentioned earlier, definitely something that I know the audience will be able to connect with. When we talk about trail building and trail maintenance, and even just the work that we do as trail advocates, there's a huge amount of labor. And a lot of that labor is unpaid volunteer work that happens. And I know in my life personally, you know, the cost of living is going up in general, but you know, how this has affected me, where I feel like my life is becoming unsustainable in a lot of ways, and I'm compromised as to what I can take on as work, especially unpaid work and volunteer work. How much is human labor taken into account with a circular economy? Because I feel like, even for me, if we just take the example of a jacket that's ripped and torn up, it's a lot of work for me to kind of figure out how to fix it, to then go through the motions of fixing it. And so where does that human piece, that labor piece, come in with a circular economy?
The human piece is what's always hardest to truly measure for a lot of sustainable certifications or assessments when it comes to production, manufacturing, communal impacts of a product, or even a service-based economy. And you make a great point where a lot of our day-to-day has to do with time and energy for us as our individual organism. And so how do you really take that in? How can you really assess for yourself or the people around you? Are we being extractive to ourselves or our own community with this work or with our day-to-day? And then how does that show up in how we interact with nature, with ourselves, with our families, with how we make decisions around what's worth our energy and time and money, right? So if someone's emotionally exhausted by their day-to-day labor or how extractive they feel like their community or their general society is to them, how much capacity do they have remaining to motivate or allow them to expand outwardly to make correct decisions around how to manage their waste or their purchases? So that's kind of something that I think about all the time, is my own capacity around that stuff, because sometimes I do feel so exhausted and demoralized by just my everyday work in this space where I, you know, ironically, I'm just like, oh my gosh, like, am I really going to have the time and energy to make this tiny decision that is probably going to be better? So like, do I take that 10-minute walk over here to try and find a recycling bin? why do I just like toss this little wrapper or a piece of paper over here instead? Like those little moments can eat at my soul sometimes where I'm like, oh my God, I just did that. But a lot of this work can weigh on you, and a lot of other things about today, the lifestyles that we have today and the cost of living, especially on this side of the planet, can really eat at us. The social ramifications of sustainability and circular economy are huge. So back to that point of regeneration, regenerative design speaks to making design choices, which translate into production and manufacturing choices, and usability choices. So how is this product used at the end of the day, that enable positive outcomes to be transmitted to communities or environments? Example being Chop Value. Chop Value is a great Vancouver-based company, and I can list off a bunch of other things happening local to us here in BC in the circular economy, where they take thrown away chopsticks and they make furniture out of them. And so what they're able to do is they're able to localize supply in a variety of different places around the world to kind of utilize that local supply of used chopsticks to make furniture pieces. Very simple things from coasters to actual desks, etc. And through this, they're able to, and this is an example, one point of mine, they're able to harness local labor to work towards a really positive environmental outcome. That kind of a localized labor force for a value or mission-oriented work objective has been shown to embolden a lot of individuals to feel, you know, that their work is thriving in a way that goes beyond them. It's about something larger than themselves, and that kind of energizes them in a way where they're able to take that back with them home or whatever other pieces of their life that they're going to be interacting in. So that's one aspect of what regenerative design can do, is making, kind of bringing people's work and time to an objective or a mission that truly aligns with how they want to be impacting the world. That's the one way that I see this really impacting the social sphere. The other is bringing communities together. So what we're trying to do with some of our work at Wonderflux is figure out, can the products we make support communal activities just inherently? Does purchasing or using a product automatically bring people together and create that connection and that discourse around why they're there, why they decided to all use or purchase or involve themselves in either an item or an activity that allows them to use that item? So I think design can be a way to bring the very physical and create emotional responses around that item based off of how it's used or how it brings people together to use it. I think really successful design can do that incredibly well. And so there's that communal aspect. There's the ability to work towards something greater or an impact-oriented mission that speaks really deeply to people. And then I think a third one is allowing for the manufacture, production, or use, or general management of something to bring about change or to educate. So beyond bringing people together, can an item or a technology or a specific material, can that spread itself outward to educate or spread awareness of something specific to other people, even to people in places of power, be it a local municipal government or a local organization that's able to lobby certain people in government or positions of power? Can it create those conversations? I think for me, those are the three buckets kind of off the top of my head that I see circular economy or regenerative design really being able to impact or leverage when it comes to finding ways to strengthen communities and environments through design that doesn't feel so extractive, but instead it feels really impactful, regenerative, and enhances that kind of growth, communal connection mindset, if any of that makes sense. Because I know that's a bit of a circuitous way to answer that question, but I hope it did.
It'd be great to hear some examples of what your company actually does. Are you able to speak to perhaps some projects or some of the contracts that you work with?
Absolutely. So right now we're working on two product ideas. Nothing's top secret. So what we're trying to do with our first one is, and again, we're all really avid backcountry users. And so what we've noticed is the amounts of plastics that we're bringing with us on our trips for a variety of reasons, you know, some being weight related, some being packability, waterproofness. There's a lot of that going on when it comes to the decisions being made around how you're packing, right? The materials you're trying to bring with you and what they can do. And are they multifunctional as well? And one thing that we noticed was trying to solve for two things at once would be a priority. And so what we decided upon was trying to figure out how to engineer a plant-based textile or film that could be used as both a very functional tape, but also a wound management system. So think bandages and tapes. So trying to find a way where we can make something that was incredibly functional and durable to solve for any repairability requirements or safety requirements, anything that you might use like a very structural tape for, think duct tape or climbing tape. And how can we pair that with a wound management care system as well? All packaged in a container that could be multifunctional as well, totally recyclable, totally reusable. So again, a big pillar of circular design is trying to make something as multifunctional as possible so that it's not only isolated to one use or application case. Another part of this for us was also, how can we start our design adventure with something that isn't necessarily rocket science? So it doesn't require extreme amounts of capital upfront, isn't quite resource intensive, and is applicable to people that we know and in the area here in the sea to sky to be able to really be able to test it, create conversations about it, and find users that are incredibly value aligned with how we kind of envision its use becoming a reality. And so for us, we're working on that project right now, which is essentially that tape and bandage idea, as well as trying to find a circular application for dehydrated meals. So this is a big one for a lot of folks. If they're, you know, first timers or incredibly avid backcountry hikers, canoeists, whatever it might be, those dehydrated meals and their packaging can be quite burdensome to carry and pack out, to utilize. They're incredibly single use. Their design makes a lot of sense. It's incredibly functional. It's just the single use realities of the materials and the applications, I think, leave something to be desired for many people. And so we've been in a few conversations with a lot of manufacturers of the dehydrated meals themselves to find a way if we can almost bulk barn this whole procedure. Can we find containers that are reusable, highly packable? Can we find, you know, certain outfitters or retailers that are able to support, you know, a bit of a more bulk purchase system? You know, think bins full of dehydrated meals or food packets, whatever it might be. So that's kind of our next project as well. It's trying to figure out, and this one's a bit different because a part of it is product design. A part of it is also getting into the mindset of buyers and how they want to be purchasing these items and managing them. And a part of it is also that more of a retail systems rethinking of what this looks like for sales and general management of a product on the shelf, so to speak, and potentially changing how retailers might want to interact with customers for this product category. So, and I'm curious if you have any thoughts related to any of that too.
Well, I mean, it touches right on kind of my very first example. There was just coming back from that backpacking trip and having this chunk of soft plastic that I've, you know, consumed through, right? Even, you know, on a one night or a two night backpacking trip, it's not that big of a deal to bring one, you know, a couple of those boil and bag meals. But I've even gone so far as to repackage those boil and bag meals into more packable Ziploc bags to try to save space here. When I'm on like a 7-day yep. trip, right? And it's now I'm consuming two plastic bags.
Yep.
You know, I'm creating more waste, and it's just it weighs on me a little bit, right? And but at the same time, you know, if I'm going out for 7 days, I can't be using stashers. You know, they're heavy and they're bulky. They also don't, and they're not 100% seal, so you end up with backpack explosions of, you know, oatmeal being everywhere. It's definitely challenging. So it's nice to kind of hear you talk about that.
I just to build up on that, actually, it's what we've noticed, or what I've noticed to be the funnest part about this, is a lot of the circular design, or maybe just the way we think about it, which is very user-centered, is the conversations we're able to have with people. where some of the conversations kind of are bouncing around just general values and like, what do you care about? What are you frustrated about? And then some of it is actually really centered around, what are you using now and how is that not working for you and how would you like that improved? And so you have a really communal design process where people are under the umbrella of certain values around environmental responsibility or communal support, whatever it might be, able to quite effectively make design choices or allow their voices to be included in a design process that they feel some type of ownership over a product as well. And that's a part of education and awareness that only can help a brand and can only help a user feel valued in what they're going to be purchasing or seeing on a shelf or explain to their friend about. And for us, I think that's one of the keys to success really for what we're trying to do, which is make people feel like their opinions and their decisions in the field are valued with how you design a product. Make them feel some type of ownership over something and they'll care for it. They'll talk about it. They'll educate others for it too. So I think that's a pretty strong pillar and an example of how powerful circular design can be when you really start to reinforce the necessities of communication and centering the people that use these things and understanding exactly where they use them and how that might differ to how you envisioned using these things in the environments or the areas that you initially thought you would as well as a designer. Environments are very different. They have different requirements. They have different life cycles. They have different weather. They have different flora and fauna that require different things, that have different varieties of elasticity to changes in the environment, changes to soil quality, things of that nature. So I think in this space, conversation is everything. Community and conversation is everything.
I think this is somewhat related to environment, but more from a people perspective. But how much does urban versus kind of rural communities make a difference in a circular economy? I feel like, you know, living in a major city, I have options when it comes to buying things in bulk. Even something as basic as being able to fill up a growler of beer at a brewery, as opposed to, you know, buying individually packaged beers. But when I look to the potential of living in a smaller community, I don't always have that option.
That's a fair question. I know a bunch of people who live in smaller communities, and when I chat with them about this type of thing, I notice that in certain ways, living in a bigger urban area, I'm currently based in Vancouver, I do have access to a greater variety of solutions. So if that's buying this item as a singular piece, or getting it in bulk, or being able to buy a bunch and easily disperse it to, you know, the number of people I have access to close to where I live. But that's also balanced with, in smaller communities, just a naturally greater necessity to lean on one another for certain things. So I find sometimes in smaller communities, from what I've been able to glean from family and friends, is that there's a greater awareness of the fact that access to certain things might not be as easy. And so let people know what you have and open your doors to being able to lend that out, and they'll do the same to you. And so I think there's a really strong attitude towards borrowing in smaller communities. Not to mention, I think sometimes there can be an even greater connection to the natural environment in a bit of a smaller circle around their general day-to-day. Again, maybe that has to do with, you know, the greater percentage of agrarian work being done in smaller communities, farming, harvesting, hunting, those types of things can kind of reinforce that connection to the natural environment and that stewardship over it. But sometimes I find in larger cities, people are slightly more okay or forced to feel like they're in a bit of a isolated mindset where maybe reaching out to random people might be a little harder than, you know, Joe Blow down the street reaching out to Rachel over there just because he knows a friend who knows her, and there's only a couple centimeters of separation there.
What are some examples of some companies that are really doing this right?
Thankfully, this type of thinking and innovation occurs in a lot of different areas in our communities and in the economy. And so happy to go through a little list here of companies that I find are doing fantastic things in their respective areas. In the food waste space, we have Food Mesh and Loop Resources. And so Food Mesh, well, both these companies are helping larger retailers, farms, divert food waste from landfill. So a lot of retailers like grocery markets are working with these companies to divert their products that they've pretty much unsold or are not really ripe anymore, like their fruits and veggies. They're diverting these items to, first of all, human-oriented charities and food banks, which is that next highest use. And then from there, if they aren't edible for those purposes, they're diverting them over to farms for local pig food. So that's a great way to kind of divert those, you know, organic-based emissions from landfill to higher uses that are just incredible for the environment, as well as farmers and communities. We have Chop Valley that I already brought up, using old used chopsticks to make furniture and other longer-term items out of. In the retail space in Vancouver, we have Soap Dispensary. I think up the Sea to Sky, we have WeFill and Be Clean, maybe Squamish-based. So kind of taking on the idea of, we'll sell you products, but you bring in your own container or you purchase a container from us that you can reuse and reuse and reuse. The single plastic space really needs that. When it comes to a very specific food item, we have Sustainable. So they were actually just on Dragon's Den, which is a great sign to show that the upcycling space is in good hands and really getting a lot of momentum here. So they're able to use spent grain from breweries and make baking items out of that. So they'll give you like a pancake mix or a cookie mix, literally made out of spent grains that breweries have thrown away to their specific use. So that's a great example of access to a material that has no value or perceived value and taking that on as a resource for a product. And I think it goes to show just how much ROI can come from this if you find the right cases for things being upcycled or reused or repurposed. So they're based in Vancouver. Then you have Anion, a clothing company based out of, I think it's Victoria. So they're using a lot of waste fabrics from other clothing brands and industries to make really high quality garments. I think what they're doing is fantastic. You have Moment Energy. I think they're based out of Coquitlam. What they're doing is they're pretty much repurposing older EV car batteries. So turning pretty much batteries that can't be used for driving anymore, strengthening them, repurposing them into batteries that can be used to power homes or small communities or off-grid communities and buildings, which is incredible work. Then you have Unbuilders and Nexi. Unbuilders, I think, is based in Vancouver. You have Nexi, N-E-X-I-I. I think they're based in Squamish. Unbuilders essentially deconstruct older buildings that would just generally be demolished, and then everything demolished from that site just goes to landfill. What they're doing is they're meticulously deconstructing older buildings to pretty much sort through all the materials that are in that building to then figure out what their highest use could be in a bit of a secondary life, as well as deconstructing in a way that allows that building to kind of maintain a structure, and they just kind of gut it and replace it with, you know, a bit of a stronger foundation, wood paneling, whatever it might be. So that kind of builds on the fact that generally impact-wise, the built environment, which is just buildings and structures of that like, can be a huge impact on what's being sent to landfill, toxins being released to the natural environment. So in this general space, I'd say the built environment is a huge one to try and solve for, and they're doing great work. And then I think lastly, we'll go to packages, so single-use packages, which is being tackled here in Vancouver by Sharewares and Loop, another Loop for you. So don't get too confused out there. But essentially kind of working with retailers and restaurants around reusable packaging and, you know, kind of getting that deposit or membership-based system for customers to be utilizing packages that they can reuse and reuse and reuse over and over and over again. A lot of good work happening out here.
Any examples of kind of more outdoor recreation focused companies? I know we talked about Patagonia there, but is there any outdoor recreation companies that are really trying to kind of tackle this stuff?
Besides the apparel companies that are really trying to utilize reused or repairable materials, To be honest with you, not much is coming to mind right now for whatever reason. I think a lot of items are made to be lasting quite long and now being repaired a lot easier than before. But I don't think there's any true examples of a company right now who's really pushing the bar in terms of materials that are either bio-based or being able to decompose in natural environments or use from waste resources. I do know that Cotopaxi's bags are generally designed in a way where they're able to use smaller scraps of materials, hence the crazy color combinations. So I really value that. I know Patagonia is definitely making things repaired, refurbished to be put back online. It's same with Arc'teryx's Rebirth program. But beyond that, like on a really specific gear level, I haven't have anything coming to mind just yet.
Yeah, I guess in the hard goods, they are generally repairable in a lot of ways. You know, I think about just to use bicycles as the example, you know, a bike holds its value for a very long time. And it is, there's a system in place to repair that. You know, we have the infrastructure there, bike shops and parts. And there's certainly frustrations that I have with mountain biking, with certain things becoming obsolete, certain standards. But with a little bit of work, I can usually find replacements and that kind of thing. It'd be great to see something similar for other entities. I think ski bindings are one of those things that I struggle sometimes to find parts for. Even buckles on ski boots, that kind of thing. So I think there's a good model in cycling there already, potentially. And it's just something to kind of see other sectors of the outdoor industry kind of follow suit.
Actually, to build on that, Brent, curious what your thoughts are on just general planned obsolescence in design of products, specifically hard goods in the outdoor space. Do you find it's just a general acceptance that, you know, in 5 years, this bolt or this item can't be replaced or utilized on a different bike or binding or board that I have? Or do you find that there are certain brands that kind of maintain a level of commitment to certain pieces or components of their products to enable repairability, modular repairability? Like, do you find that's a pretty strong characteristic of the industry?
I feel like it isn't anymore. I think it potentially once was, and that's slipping away. And that's a lot of my frustration and even things that question my career as a guide and an outdoor educator, is that I'm struggling to replace gear at the rate that I need to replace gear because it's failing me at a higher rate. You know, something I did because I own my own business, and so with that comes a lot of paperwork and bookkeeping, and so I have an accurate document of every purchase I've ever made for the last decade, and I went through that and pulled out all of the gear that I bought over the last 10 years, and with a little bit of Excel magic, was able to kind of see the timeline of how I replace certain items. And it's a bit scary. You know, even my compass is getting to the point where I can't read any of the numbers on it because they've all rubbed off. And it's only like a little over 2 years old. And so I feel like there's less dependability there. And I've even found myself taking a step backwards in some of my gear and finding used products, not because it's cheaper or I don't want to spend the money on something new, but because the older stuff was more maintainable and repairable. And so some of my, like I have a setup of Telemark skis, which in and of itself is dated and old fashioned, but my Tele setup, one of the bindings that I have, there's actually spare screws hidden inside the binding, which from the perspective of being in the middle of the backcountry and something goes wrong, you need that stuff there. But I think where some companies might hesitate with that is it infers the possibility that this thing's going to fail. And that's where I think we need to get away from that. And part of what I love about skiing and mountain biking and why I do those sports and activities as opposed to, you know, play baseball or soccer or football is because failure is just a huge part of those sports and activities. In fact, some of the most fun that I've ever had on my skis is when I'm failing. That's just part of it. Crashing is hilarious when you're on a pair of skis and you'd go for a cartwheel in the powder. And that's what's fun about it. And so, you know, when I buy something, I don't expect it to last forever. But I do wish that I could fix it and repair it. And that's something that I've been struggling with a lot lately. And it's even gotten to the point where I've questioned the hobbies that I even do. You know, I have a bicycle right now that's 10 years old, and it feels like it's a dinosaur to try to get it fixed and repaired. And I don't want the solution to be buy a new bike. I think I can get a couple more years out of this bike and keep it going. But it seems like the industry is set up to just go, well, it's been 10 years. You have to buy a new bike. And then I can't even fix it. So it's not like I could even sell it to somebody. So then it's just like, am I actually going to throw this thing out at this point? And that just doesn't seem right.
Yeah. And I think those sentiments weigh heavy for a lot of us. I would actually be personally really curious about if you ever had this miracle amount of time given to you to sift through those purchases over the last decade and, you know, be able to fill out, okay, was this repairable, but just wasn't designed to be repaired? Would this have been repairable if I had the proper components still available to me? Was this just poorly made? Was the quality great, but the repairability low? And just kind of see, like, what were the challenges I was facing with this gear? And is there a common thread here? Would there have been a common solution? That would just be interesting to know about, but that's just my nerd coming through. And I know you're way too busy for that, but there might be a lesson there. Who knows?
Well, and it's definitely something I've give more thought to each day. There's a program. It's still not launched just yet, but and this is I've plugged it a few times on the podcast, but something that I absolutely love and is public libraries, and my partner, she's a librarian as well. So which love came first? I don't know, but.
I love libraries. They're so powerful. Good for her. I respect that a lot. That's terrific.
It's a wonderful space. And one of the things that our local library is sewing machines. And they're just trying to come up with the programming that's around that and how that's all going to work. But something that I can't wait to be able to get my hands on is, you know, these sewing machines, where I know that, you know, I took home ec for one grade in high school. I can sew a little bit, and when it comes to my outdoor gear, it doesn't have to look perfect anyways. I don't even care if the thread matches or anything. It's littered in patches and anyways. So it just needs to work. And so that's something that I'm looking forward to, is being able to kind of get my hands on a sewing machine and just fix up a couple things or repurpose a few items as well and make something new. Even just something as simple as taking a ripped tarp and maybe trimming off some of it and just making it a little bit smaller, but kind of keeping its life going.
And that's building on something that I think we have to chat about quickly, is how in the outdoor recreation space, patches are badges of honor. Mm. I love when my Patagonia jackets are looking super unique with a bunch of patches and rips and various threads running through them. I think that's a total badge of honor. And I think it reflects the mindset of repairability and figuring out puzzles and just pushing through and making things your own. And just like the connection a lot of us can have to gear that at least is made to a level of quality that we appreciate and that we want to maintain and keep alive, because maybe there's memories attached to that bag or that jacket or that fleece. Right. There's a very emotional part of all this for us in terms of the gear you use or put on a shelf or fix or have stowed away for who knows when you might need it again. There's stories that place themselves over top the gear you have. And there's memories and emotions over top of that as well, that I think really align themselves well with the mindset of the people that are using them, and also the objectives and the pillars of sustainability overall. There's an emotional component to all this that I think is amazing. And building on your library thought there, and kudos to that program on the sewing machines, because I think that's an incredibly powerful skill to have. But also, how empowering would it be if we had little gear workshop repair depots available to anyone who might need it? maybe a membership or per use basis of like kids going in there to repair a shoelace or something, to a man with a snowboard binding or a lady with a mower. How powerful would it be if we just had a normalized access point to knowledge around repairability, tools, and access to whatever it might be? I think that could be a brilliant way to go for certain communities.
Well, it touches on something that, I mean, for me, it's very easy to get overwhelmed at how big, whatever our challenges are, there's many of them in life.
We can agree on that.
Yeah. And so I can get kind of, I can get to a point where it feels, you feel helpless, that you're just, what's the point? You're not going to be able to fix everything. And so why bother trying it in some respects? And so, you know, thinking local, thinking small. And so one of the projects that I'm trying to work on right now is, we have a room in we live in this, relatively small building. It's a 30 unit building. So it's a small community. It kind of touches on that what you mentioned there with that kind of urban and rural. And I feel like because we are such a small building, I have a better sense of community with my neighbors. And so we've got a room in this building that is really not used for anything. There's just a bunch of junk in it. And I'm working at kind of cleaning this up so that we can just unlock that door and let people do what they want in that space. There's a workbench in there. You know, it's just kind of a dank, dark storage room, but it's got a bench, it's got a light. And you know, I know for me, I look at it and go like, this is a great space where I could, you know, work on my bicycle and not have to worry about getting grease all over my living room floor. And so we're trying to kind of get this space cleaned up and working for us. But, you know, I'd love to see people in there, you know, fixing whatever it is that they need to fix, and just giving people that space to do that.
I love that. And I'll agree with you on that last point. Learning and awareness can sometimes be so tremendously expanded if there's a safe space for people to be able to exist within, to accept and test and learn. Space is so important. And I think that's an amazing idea. And I wouldn't be surprised if you put up a little poster at some point where like, hey, I'm going to go fix this about my bike. If you want to know how this works, come join me. We can figure it out together. You might have a couple of people pop by.
Just to wrap things up, I'd love to kind of hear any final thoughts that you might have. Maybe let people know what you're kind of thinking of next, or where you're headed next, and maybe how people can get in touch with you as well.
Absolutely. What am I thinking of? I'm in this whole space of sustainability, innovation, and circular economy. I think what I'm trying to really keep a finger on the pulse on is watching how companies are trying to innovate under the pressures of certain legislation. So we're seeing a lot of plastic regulation happening, and there's a lot of, you know, top-down governmental guidance occurring to help companies kind of try and push the bar, even if this is through investments. I'm trying to keep my eye on how consumer-oriented companies are trying to innovate with their circular programs, so their take-back, their repairing programs, how they're able to utilize new technologies with materials. So a lot of companies are now testing recycling polymers through polyester-based fabrics, et cetera, to reuse those elements into new clothing. Things of that nature, I think, are really exciting. I'm looking for bottom-up signs that education and awareness are increasingly strengthening themselves. So community-based actions, be it flea markets, or reusability programs, or small little reuse cafes, things of that nature that just like seem to be kind of showing you what's happening or what's important in various communities. I think that's also a great sign of a lot of positive, innovative thinking. And then I'm also just like touching base with my own community close by to like figure out, you know, am I existing in a vacuum, or are people around me kind of struggling with the same things and asking the same questions? I think it's always worth having conversations with the community very close to you, because sometimes we lose track of, you know, what the questions people are asking in terms of why do we do this way instead of this way. And I think if you continue to have those questions and conversations with people very close by to you, that network effect will occur, and that'll be able to spread, and you'll be able to get things from there. Networks that are slightly beyond your grasp as well. And that osmosis can really create really interesting things that, again, come from the bottom up, which I just absolutely adore. So those are kind of the big things for me, just like to kind of keep my eyes out over the next few years here, because this is gaining a lot of momentum in the food space, in the textile space, in the outdoor recreation space, in the gear and material space. And I think it's only going to get cooler what we're able to do with a circular mindset and a lot of these circular innovations. Because costs are rising too, and to be able to recycle, repurpose, upcycle materials and resources can be a lot cheaper than buying virgin materials. So that's a thing to keep out in front of you as you are out there trying to purchase at a retailer or online shopping, is trying to dig a little deeper into seeing like who's extending the life of certain materials that allow me to kind of lower the impact automatically on whatever I buy. Folks can reach me on Instagram. Well, I'm sure we can leave a handle there. That's just Muggsy, as well as Miguel at wonderflux.ca. If you have any questions or concerns from a personal standpoint, or if you're dealing with things in your business that you might want some support with, we're happy to help with anything around materials, strategy, marketing, communications, anything that can allow companies, organizations to extend their impacts outwardly to communities and environments that they care about. So yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll put those links in our show notes. And Miguel, thanks so much for taking the time to have this conversation. It's been wonderful.
Absolutely, Brent. Thank you so much.
This episode of the podcast, my guest and I recorded our conversation on the traditional territory of the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, Musqueam, and Stolo Nations. If you're curious to learn more about the traditional territory that you occupy and recreate on, then visit native-lands.ca. Like always, you can find the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FrontlinesMTB. You can also join the Facebook group at Advocates on the Frontlines of MTB. And you can send me an email or audio file to info@frontlinesmtb.com. You can stream the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. And if you haven't done so already, leave a review on wherever you get the show. It helps others find the podcast. Big thanks to Alexa, Drew, Jacob, and Jeff for supporting the show via PayPal. Don't forget to support the show via PayPal. You can find a link in the show notes. And in the show notes, you'll also find a link to Wonderflux and Miguel Santos. Music, as always, is by Lee Rosevere. Production notes by Jennifer Pride. Artwork is created by Brandon Gallagher-Watson and BGW Creative. And finally, I'm Brent Hillier. This is Frontlines. Thanks for listening, and happy trails.